Welcome to a new season of Know Your Media. We're your hosts, Betsy Bruner.
And Maliga Och.
Today we're going to talk about an issue that has been in the media a lot lately, and that's the issue of mass shootings and gun violence and all of the conversations about gun control that have occurred and are occurring on media outlets like CNN and Fox News, social media outlets like Twitter and Facebook, as well as stakeholder-created media outlets like NRA TV.
So before we start, I think it's good to remind us what a mass shooting actually is. And the official definition in the U.S. is any shooting that results in more than four people killed or injured is considered a mass shooting. And Mother Jones actually has a perfect database where they collect information on mass shootings, the shooters, the casualties, the dead. So since 1982, there have been 114 mass shootings in the U.S. And if you average this out, that amounts to about three mass shootings per year. But 68% of those 115 mass shooting, and that's about 78, have occurred since 2004, when the automatic weapon ban expired. Likewise, since 2004, there have been 672 deaths. That's twice as much dead people from mass shootings than between 1982 and 2004. So we've seen a rapid increase in mass shootings and casualties since 2004.
And as these stories emerge, we see them taken up by a variety of media outlets. Obviously, in 1982, we didn't have social media yet. Media scholars and others have pointed out that the 24-hour mass media cycle really influences how we talk about gun violence and gun control. So the debate on television has become increasingly more polarized and heated and partisan, which actually doesn't represent the public opinion on the issue. So we see social media actually as well, and we see these mass media outlets reporting on gun violence, and they seem to say that people either want total freedom to have whatever gun they want, or they want all guns banned. And in actuality, most people actually prefer just what is called common sense gun control measures. So a February 2019 Reuters poll of almost 7,000 adults found that 69% of Americans, including 85% of Democrats and 57% of Republicans, want strong or moderate restrictions placed on firearms. And some of the things that people agree on is that over 80% of people think that guns should be banned from the mentally ill. Over 80% of people think that we should expand background checks. About 80% of the people think that we should track sales with U.S. databases and so forth. So actually, a lot of people do want restrictions placed on guns. Now, when we see mass shootings talked about on social media outlets, we have to also consider the format of social media. So social media outlets are really energized by liking, by sharing, and by commenting. So the more a post gets liked or shared or commented on, the higher up it goes in feeds. So the stories that get the most attention are often ones that are the most divisive, that make people angry and respond. So when we're watching social media rather than participating in the conversation, a lot of times we're only seeing the most dramatic conversations about gun rights and gun control that are happening, and it doesn't reflect the reality, which is that most people are for, you know, some increased regulation. Now, there's also stakeholder-created media outlets like NRA TV, and those are really designed to appeal to a wide variety of NRA members and potential NRA members. So this includes women using guns for self-protection, hunters using guns to kill wild game, and Black urban populations who see gun ownership as an important right for defending oneself. And this media is designed to create a sort of community among gun owners and also recruit new people into the NRA.
So there also seems to be a certain script that is shared across media outlets when discussing the occurrence of a mass shooting. So first we express horror and shock at what has happened. Then we offer our thoughts and prayers. And then some people start talking about gun control. And this usually then results in cries that this is not a time for politics, we should not talk about gun control, when a community is still mourning the people they have lost through mass shooting violence. And then eventually in this fast-paced news cycle, people move on and we don't really ever go back to talking about gun control. So the question we really want to explore today is, how do media shape gun violence and mass shootings? Like, how do they frame the problem? And what kind of solutions do media outlets discuss? Does it differentiate between what social media users see compared to more traditional media outlets? And can we hope to see a potential outcome or result off of these proposed solutions?
To discuss this topic, we've invited Dr. Justin Eckstein to join us. Justin is an assistant professor of communication at Pacific Lutheran University, and he's also the director of the TOH Carl Forensics Forum. He wanted to let us all know that he loves pizza as well. He studies multimodal advocacy, which is really just a fancy way of saying how senses supply strategic resources. His work canvasses a number of issues, including food, sound, and guns. He co-edited the book Cookery, Rhetorics of Social Production, and he's also published a lot of peer-reviewed articles in a number of different academic journals. We invited him here today to be part of this conversation because he has published a good number of pieces on guns, including an essay titled Since Sandy Hook. He also recently gave a talk in Las Vegas titled The Parkland Kids Are All Right, and has worked extensively on the gun advocacy of Emma Gonzalez, who features prominently in his current book that is in process, Sound Tactics and the Acoustics of the Public. So welcome, Justin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay. So we're going to start by asking you kind of a large question. So what are some common misperceptions about the gun debate people have as a result of the way that media is portraying it?
Yeah, I thought this was a really good question. And I want to start sort of broadly because I think some of the misperceptions about the way the media portray it actually hide the way the media operates in the gun debate itself. So whenever a mass shooting happens, they're typically in the news cycle for about 6 days, according to The Atlantic, right? That's 6 days from, oh my God, there's a mass shooting, to it's we see the vigil, to it's no longer in the cycle. And during that 6 day period, we tend to focus exclusively on the verifiable damage that we can see and we know. And these come to us in statistics like death, as well as like injury. Right. What we don't really see is the invisible damage that's done in terms of psychological harm to people who survived the shooting, who might not even seen the shooter. Anecdotally, for instance, Dr. Bruner, I did my PhD in Colorado, and inevitably I knew people who went and survived the Columbine shooting. And I remember that they would talk about every time there's a mass shooting, they would be triggered, forgive the poor choice of words. And the way she lived with that experience every day in forms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and those sort of things aren't reported on the news. And part of that is pragmatic. They don't know that in the immediate 6 day span. How do you report that? How do you verify that?
Isn't that also now slowly coming back in the media after two, I think it was parents of shooting victims, one in Sandy Hook and I think maybe one of the Parkland survivor kids who were killed. They ended up committing suicide. Does that also fit in this like long-term effect that the media doesn't talk about?
That's an excellent question. Well, this gets at how I see the media actually playing into this larger role is that, so you're right, on March 24th, the media reported that two people, which was around a 1 year anniversary from the March for Our Lives, two of the Sandy Hook people, or I'm not sorry, not the Sandy Hook, the Parkland kids, more Parkland kids committed suicide. The very next day on March 25th, one of the Jeremy Richmond, an advocate of the Sandy Hook parent, a parent of one of the Sandy Hook kids, killed himself. Right. And I think this gets at the broader media ecology and the way that these different events reported play off each other. Right. Malcolm Gladwell had this famous essay way back when. I know Malcolm Gladwell is a vexed figure to some, but he had a really interesting essay in 1999 about school shootings and talking about how they were kind of like a contagion. And he cited the media in the way that they're contagious. right? Because the media would broadcast them and other people would be like, maybe this is a good idea. And this sort of demonstrates how it puts sort of things out there. And so there's a reason why just recently we saw a rash of shootings all of a sudden happen again, and they follow contagion-like models. And when you see suicides, there's a rash-like contagion around them, right? And there's a bunch of social scientific models that seem to back up this.
So do you think that the news reporting then on some of these traumatic after effects like PTSD and suicides will change the conversation so that we see mass shootings not as a singular kind of event that really we can't do anything about, right? We can't redo time and stop it, to something that has these lasting impacts and repercussions that we need to tend to in a different way, or maybe even take action in a different way, or design gun control measures in a different way.
Well, I think we need to tend to them in a much more deliberate, extensive way, and not just be like, okay, we're done here, right? Then recognize that these are going to have long-term consequences that kids and parents and the community are going to deal with in a long period of time. And like, think about what happened after Sandy Hook, right? When you have someone like Alex Jones propagating this ridiculous conspiracy theory that it didn't happen. Imagine being the parent. And this is another media ecology, by the way, where you have right-wing media and these echo chambers now proliferating conspiracy theories that are then given credence because they're in echo chambers, that this isn't real.
So
right? And they're blasting emails and calling up the parents and protesting and doing all of these things, right? This is how it perpetuates, these ecologies perpetuate themselves.
And I think that reminds me of a podcast that I recently listened to, and the host brought up a very interesting question that I can't stop thinking about, also from an intercultural perspective, that I'm really curious to get your take on it. So he essentially said that after mass shootings, we get a sanitized version of what happened. We see the photos of the people who were killed, but these are photos where they are full of life, they look adorable, they look happy, and we do not see the actual casualties. Like, we don't see the puddles of blood, we don't see photos of the victims being dead or being shot up or being injured. So it's the gruesomeness of what a mass shooting actually looks like is withheld from the viewer or from the media consumer. And related to this, like, this has, I've noticed that also in other contexts where, for example, when the Iraq war started, there were a couple of U.S. soldiers who unfortunately were mutilized during the invasion. And when I was in the U.S. at that time, and I didn't understand why the German media was so outraged and people were like emotionally upset, until I realized that in the US I only saw pixeled images of those soldiers, and in Germany they showed everything. It was not a pixelated image, so you saw the full brutality of what the terrorists had done to those soldiers. And I'm wondering if this shapes how we see mass shootings, or if we can remain immune from mass shootings if we don't really see the reality of them to a certain extent.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question. I think you're right. In the United States, we see, and I emphasize on see, because that's all we do is see. You don't hear. We only see a particular iteration of the mass shooting, and it is the school, the first responders rushing to the scene, emotional friends and families, people mourning at a vigil, and pictures of the shooter. And taken together, these images create a visual scene for how the public senses mass shootings. Absent from the narratives are the actual carnage inside the school. We get emotional testimony of the survivors, and these create the what I call, you know, the epistemological scene for us, how we know what constitutes a school shooting, and they're entirely bloodless.
Well, didn't Parkland change that, though? Because so many of the students, you know, were sending live video of what was occurring.
Yeah, Parkland did change it. And that's what I think is so fascinating about Parkland, and why I've spent so much time studying it. And one of the things that's so notable is it changed the debate. So prior to Parkland, students were relatively understood as passive stakeholders. They were just seen as people, as just we were debating about what's best for students. They were sort of passive agents in the discussion. So you had both sides. My essay that I wrote with Dr. Partlow Lefebvre, your colleague, we discussed how the debate pivoted on this question of technological agency, right? Do we think that guns have agency or not, right? That's what you can break down the American gun debate into.
Can you explain it a little bit better what it means, or not better, but people who are less familiar with the debate, what it means for a gun to have agency?
Yeah, so essentially the question is, guns don't kill people, people kill people, begs the question of, does a gun have the capacity to change, to do something in a scenario, right? And that's an old NRA talking point. And when I say guns have agency, no, I don't mean does it have the capacity to stand up and walk around, right? It's a more nuanced sense of agency in its capacity to amplify the potential for violence, right? And it's because agency resides in the, you know, Deleuzian virtual, which I know might be outside the meaning of a lot of your listeners, and that's the problem, because it's a nuanced account of what agency means that it might get lost in the realm of public argument. Essentially, it's a force multiplier. If I bring a gun into a situation, the chance for violence infinitely increases. I can kill a lot more people with a gun than I can a knife, is all that sort of what I mean by agency, right? It increases my potential. But that's what a lot of the debate sort of hinges on. And because it's a nuanced understanding of agency, that becomes difficult. But what's important to know is that that question of, is a gun an agent or not, is a question of worldview, right? In the academic world, that's the debate of technological determinism, right? And yeah, we might have gradations. Actor network theory, as Dr. Bruner might speak to, is a particular iteration of it. And you have different gradations and so on and so forth. But in the public, they don't see that.
So do you think that one of the reasons why we're not seeing the violence with the school shootings is because we would be seeing dead children as opposed to dead adults, which is a totally different category, right?
Although we also don't see the dead adults either.
We don't see the dead adults, or we haven't for... In the Boston Marathon bombing, there was the sharing of the picture on Facebook of a man with his leg blown off, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of debate over whether or not that should be shown. And Facebook, people complained on Facebook that it should be taken down because it was too graphic. And Facebook had this internal meeting where they said, no, we think that people need to see the violence that is going on. So I'm wondering, like, yes, it's sanitized altogether in the United States, but like, is it more of a protected category because it's children? And we don't have, you need permission, right? You want permission from their parents in order to show those images. Just like when somebody's killed in war, you need permission from their family to show their dead body.
Yeah, that's a great question. I know that there was a debate that happened after Sandy Hook, actually, about whether or not they should show the carnage inside and whether those photos should be leaked. And they ultimately said no, that we shouldn't be able to because they were too horrific. But the debate being, well, if we did, maybe people would change their mind. And I mean, as you saw after Parkland, when those photos were leaked, did they change their mind? Maybe, maybe not. I think that...
Well, do you think that... I mean, arguably, Parkland has been the most successful... the movement that has sprung out of Parkland has been the most successful. I wonder if some of it can be attributed to the horror that was elicited by the images, as well as the activism of the students and them really organizing.
Well, what I think was so fascinating about Parkland is when it enabled us a new way of understanding and sensing, right? Because that's what I go to. We were able to see inside the school because for a long time, the school became a black box. We were never able inside the school except for like a rare couple exceptions. Like we saw Dylan Kybold, right, in Columbine. There's a famous image of him inside the school. But by and large, we never were able to see inside a school during a school shooting. Because we're able to see inside and hear it, like you can't underscore like the Doppler effect of listening to bullets reverberating down a very like close hallway and the screams, the viscerality of that. I think it enabled, and they're all shot from the perspective of the student, it enabled them to reclaim agency. And then they became stakeholders and no longer became what's best to do for students, but what students wanted. And they were able to enact and demand claims in a way that made them relevant stakeholders in the debates about guns.
Okay.
And I thought that was what was unique about Parkland. And then so when you look at the deliberations that started happening and when they extended, because the debate, while the news cycle lasted 6 days on average, it stretched 6 weeks after Parkland. What was really unique about them was that there was this ad hominem debate. The debate didn't become traditional, fall into partisan lines, which it does, and it wanted to. It really wanted to fall along partisan lines. But it became rather, should kids have an opinion? Are they mature enough to have an opinion about guns? Do they have a well-developed brain, or are they being manipulated by others? And so that's what the debate became about, because the other positions didn't really know what to do with these kids.
Yeah.
Right? And then they had this special position as survivors.
So, and I think sticking with this idea of changing narrative frames, another change that I have noticed is that the media now no longer refers to the shooters by name. I haven't really seen a photo of the shooter oftentimes in the media. Is that something that is more common, or it depends on the media outlet?
So I can talk about that a little bit. So there's a movement that is really geared toward eliminating the shooter's name from all mass media coverage. And the reason why is because people think, and rightly in many cases, that the shooter is seeking some kind of their minute of fame before they go out. And it also, they're afraid, encourages copycat shootings. And so there's a movement to get news outlets to just stop saying the shooter's name to help prevent that, you know, minute of fame and the subsequent copycat shootings. So, Justin, what do you think we can do as media consumers to help understand the nuances of the debate better? Like, what should we be looking at? What should we be not feeding, right? Like, not liking, not watching, not sharing. What should we be contemplating? And what should we, like, ask of or be posting, right, if we are active social media users?
I'm not going to win any favors with this one, but I really think you're doing a disservice thinking the other side is wrong and crazy. I really think that trying to understand the other side's perspective as much as possible is really the best thing you can do. And understand that the other side, whatever you believe, has some degree of merit, right? That people who think that we should have guns for whatever reason that they might believe have degrees of merit to their position, or people who think that we should restrict guns to some degree have merit, and try to understand why that position is. So I think that trying to discount a person as a gun nut or a libtard or whatever potential reason we have doesn't get us anywhere. It just shuts down the conversation. And I think instead trying to understand why they might believe this and what reasons they have and why they might be reasonable is really the starting point, where I see a lot of the conversation, and this is true not just in the public but in the academic world too, starts from the assumption that they're just wrong and won't move or progress any forward. So I think starting with degrees of charity is a really good starting point.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And in fact, I was teaching a course on activism and social change, and we talked about the gun debate. And my students were really reticent to talk with one another about it because they were afraid they were going to just be on one side or the other, when in fact, they A, had many points of agreement, and B, began to understand that some of the reasons why people wanted to be able to keep their guns for, you know, self-protection, for you know, some people that want perhaps the freest or the least restrictions on guns are people who are the most concerned about government imposition. And they're not pro one side or the other. So it's pretty, I think that you're right. If we start to understand, like the key to some of it is understanding why people are coming from where they're coming from, instead of just, this is my thought, this is yours, and you're wrong.
It might have merit.
Yeah,
right.
It does.
That this issue is really complicated, and that you are not the king, queen, or whatever potential monarchical gendered position you may occupy. Yeah, like I heard Killer Mike's justification for gun control.
And who is Killer Mike?
Killer Mike from Run the Jewels. Oh my gosh, Betsy. Oh.
I also don't know that person or fictional character.
Oh, he's not fictional. He is amazing. Michael Render.
Okay. I
recommend go download Run the Jewels. Y'all, if you're listening to this and if you not listen to Run the Jewels, amazing. He stumps for Bernie. Okay. As well. He's a frequent guest on Bill Maher. And just a really good rapper. He has a show as well on Netflix.
Sounds like an interesting character.
Yeah, his justification for why he has a gun. It's a really complicated, nuanced issue. And to just reduce it down to a simplistic soundbite really misses the point.
So I think that we're all out of time for today. Thank you so much, Justin, for being with us. This episode of Know Your Media was recorded at the KISU studios on the Idaho State University campus. We would like to thank Damon Anderson for his continued help with and support of this show. The audio recording is available online at PRX.
A quick point of interest, KISU is migrating all of the digital content away from PRX and now toward KISU.org. Find tonight's episode of Know Your Media on the homepage at KISU.org. Know Your Media returns on October 14th with your host, Dr. Zach Gershberg. The Los Angeles Times writes, after the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio, over the weekend, singer-songwriter Lana Del Rey was moved to craft this emotional song called Looking for America.
Looking for my own version of America. One without the gun where the flag can freely fly.
Half an hour special of With Good Reason coming up next here on KISU FM.